phase of the human trial next month. At the same time, Iran has imported the first batch of Russia's Sputnik V and will kickstart its mass vaccination this week.
With COVPARS making its way to the human trial stage, COVIran now has a top rival on its way toward the market. For now, Iran is a few months away from a marketable local vaccine. And until then, officials say Russia's Sputnik V will dominate Iran's inoculation program. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has held a national exhibition to showcase its latest scientific and technological achievements on the occasion of the 42nd victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In this exhibition, 160 projects on such fields as healthcare, agriculture, defense, electronics, oil, and nanomaterials were unveiled. 90% of the proposed projects have reached production phase.
We process chitosan, which is a sugar that is obtained from the hard outer skeleton of shellfish like shrimp. Our company has processed chitosan at three grades which can be commercialized. Chitosan can be used in different fields like medicine, agriculture, textiles, and cosmetics, and etc. This will save the country hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Manufactured portable GPU or ground power unit, which is used to start the engines of light aircraft and helicopters. If you fully charge it one time, our GPU is capable of starting engines 9 times. This GPU can be used for devices which need high voltage.
Iran is a leading country in the region in terms of global innovation. According to the Global Innovation Index 2020 report, Iran ranks 26th worldwide for the share of its high-tech industries in the national production, surpassing the regional countries such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey.
At this exhibition, we are witnessing the emergence of new talents in our society. As you know, the enemies are trying to impose different forms of sanctions on our nation, but we have cut off the hands of dependence. We believe that sanction was one of the great historic opportunities for the Iranian nation throughout history. We have always stood on our own feet, and today the Iranian youth are moving the country on the path of independence.
According to the Scopus International Citation Database, the rate of scientific contributions of Iranian researchers to the world increased from 17% in 2011 to 31% in 2020, becoming the world's leading country in science diplomacy, with 14% growth.
In the past 42 years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in many fields, including science and technology. And now it has become one of the leading countries in scientific achievements in the world. Sama Kujuri, Tehran.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the country will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the United States lifts all its sanctions first. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, is the name of the nuclear deal Iran clinched in 2015 with world powers, including the US. But America withdrew from the accord under former President Donald Trump and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. Now, the new president, Joe Biden, says the US will return to the deal, but Iran must first return to full compliance. Iran rejects this, arguing that it was the U.S. that exited the accord and breached its commitments. Ayatollah Khamenei says it is the definitive and irreversible policy of Iran that the U.S. should first lift its sanctions. The leader also says that it's Iran that has the right to set conditions on the nuclear deal, as it has fulfilled all its commitments under the agreement. The leader's comments follow calls by some Western countries to renegotiate the Iran deal and expand it beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. We have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region. And this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now.
Iran has time and again stressed that the JCPOA is non-negotiable. The country rolled back some of its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after the US pullout. Iran did so after the European countries in the JCPOA, namely France, Britain and Germany, failed to make up for the US withdrawal. Tehran has repeatedly said its rolling back measures are fully reversible once other parties fulfill their commitments. Iran says the ball is now in US court. It says President Biden should now decide on whether to continue the policies of his predecessor or choose a new path. Those policies by Trump under his so-called maximum pressure campaign have already been described as a failure, even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Afghanistan received the first consignment of COVID-19 vaccines from India under India's commitments to support the country and health sector. As officials say, the first shipment of the vaccine would be sufficient for only 3% of Afghan population. This comes as Afghanistan is still struggling with the COVID-19 amid shortage of medical equipment.
India have been a great a partner for health sector of Afghanistan in the past years, and this time this is the first country who is came out in the first line and support the health sector of Afghanistan by donation of 500,000 vaccines. For sure, these vaccines will be used for the health workforce, which are the first line people against war, for the war against COVID-19 virus in the country.
Afghanistan has already received different shipments and aid from China, Iran and the US to fight the pandemic in 2020. As officials in Kabul say, those at greater risk will be the first recipients of these vaccines. But many had doubt such claims, saying the widespread mismanagement of the first wave of COVID-19 in Afghanistan has tarnished the image of responsible bodies, such as the Ministry of Public Health and some other bodies.
We expect the government to really vaccinate our brave security and defense forces, plus those who are involved in fight against COVID-19 first in accordance to the latest decree of the president. There must be no mismanagement this time.
The World Bank has allocated $100 million and the Asian Development Bank has granted $50 million to provide Afghanistan with the COVID-19 vaccine. Meanwhile, Iran and China are among those countries that have so far assisted the Afghan government in its fight against the pandemic and the different collaborative attempts.
Based on official figures released by Afghanistan's Public Health Ministry, over 50,000 individuals have been infected with COVID-19 so far. Nearly 2,500 of them have died of the disease. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Palestinian leadership has praised the International Criminal Court for its ruling that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories, allowing its chief prosecutor, Fatou Ben Souda, to investigate Israeli atrocities, despite fierce objections from Tel Aviv. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtayi said the decision is a victory for justice, humanity, and freedom, and for the blood of the victims, namely the Palestinians and their families. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also praised the ruling and said it's ready to cooperate with the ICC's prosecutor if an investigation is launched.
We urge the International Court and its chief prosecutor to immediately launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinian people. We have already filed several legal complaints against Israel with the ICC. We are now ready to carry out every possible effort to see Israeli military officials and settlers being prosecuted for their crimes.
The ICC's ruling, however, has angered the Israeli regime, as its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed the ruling as a political tribunal, accusing the ICC for being a political body and not a legal institution. Israel has not joined the International Criminal Court, but the Palestinian Authority is a signatory since 2015. This means the ICC's mandate is to prosecute people, not countries, including those from states that are not signatories, and in this case, Israeli leaders, military officials, and soldiers who are accused of carrying out crimes against Palestinians.
I doubt that that will make such a difference in Israel, because if we know the nature of Israel, and it's based on violence, based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and grabbing the land of Palestine, because of that, I don't think that will make a big difference for the Israeli policies in the region.
The Palestinians have asked the court to look into Israeli crimes during its 2014 war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as Israel's construction of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
The ICC's decision paves the way for the tribunal's prosecutor to open a war crime investigation. But the main question lingering in mind is that will the U.S., which has furiously condemned the court, allow prosecution of Israeli officials and forces over their crimes committed in the Palestinian territories? Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks. The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population. U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian sky.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Kashmir is one of the most beautiful regions in the world, but continues to be in crisis. Now, the region has had an uncertain future since 1947. With the partition of India, both Pakistan and India have claimed the area, as well as a smaller part by China, and the United Nations ruled that a plebiscite must be carried out. However, New Delhi has refused to allow the region to vote. And 18 months ago, India tightened its grip on Kashmir, revoking Article 370, which had given the region semi-autonomy. And the situation continues to deteriorate and be unresolved. Stay with us as we take a look at the latest in the region of Kashmir on this debate.
People march on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir. With tensions continue to increase, there is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Kashmir Institute for International Affairs, Muzammil Ayub Thakir, President of the World Kashmir Freedom Movement out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto, and Zafar, why do you think that in August of 2019, India revoked the limited autonomy that it had given the region? What was the goal of that?
Well, ever since the current regime in India came to power under Narendra Modi, he follows a very extremist, racist ideology of Hindutva, which basically negates the rights of all minorities, even inside India, let alone in Kashmir. And Kashmir, of course, as in the introduction it was pointed out, had enjoyed a special status since the Indian forces illegally occupied it in October of 1947. We need to step back a little bit and understand that according to the partition plan of 1947, Muslim majority areas were to constitute the state of Pakistan and Hindu majority areas were to go with India. Now, Kashmir was and remains a Muslim majority area, but it had a Hindu ruler, and regrettably, while the people of Kashmir wanted to become part of Pakistan, the ruler, through a sleight of hand, what is referred to as the instrument of accession, it was a temporary measure. He went with India, but India pledged at that time that the wishes of the people would be respected, There are 11 Security Council resolutions that call for a referendum in Kashmir. Initially, India promised that it would abide by those resolutions. Now it has backed out of it. And because India feels that it is militarily more powerful, it has a Hindu nationalist government in power, that they do not recognize the rights of the Kashmiri people. And we see this crisis that intensified on August the 5th of 2019.
Well, Mudammil, what do you think? What does India want by pressuring this region? As the guests in Toronto said, that region is a majority Muslim region with the various declarations from the United Nations and saying that they should be able to vote on their status, whether they want to be a part of Pakistan or India or independent. But India isn't allowing that. What is India after exactly by what it's doing?
It's a very good question. I think we need to, it's something that your guest touched upon. It's a neo-colonial imperialist expansionist program of settler colonialism and demographic change. That's exactly what India wants to do. And if these terms sound familiar, that's because it is familiar. It's exactly what the Nazis had suggested and what they talked about when they performed the Holocaust and when they were against the Jews. And these people, the RSS, the BJP is backed by the RSS. The RSS is a parent organization, designated terrorist organization in the past. It was even banned in India in the 40s and in the late 40s. It's the same organization that took responsibility for the killing of Mohandas, or rather what other people call Mahatma Gandhi. So you understand what kind of organization this is. And their entire agenda, which they openly accept, is an expansionist program. They openly admire Hitler. They openly claim to take direction from the Nazi Germany handbook. And their entire agenda is Akhand Bharat. The term they use is Akhand Bharat, a pan-Hindu nation, one party, one nation, one ideology. And that's exactly what they want to do. And there's so much proof of this in their own literature and in the media that exists in India. The BJP has become a reason for fanaticism. It's easier to radicalize people in India because of the lack of literacy and the lack of information that exists, and the fact that they are not as quite well-informed as the rest of the international counterparts, so they are easily more radicalized, the same way exactly how the Germans did under the Nazis. So we have to recognize exactly what they want to do and why they're doing it. Kashmir is part of the bigger program. After Kashmir, they started tampering with the CAA and the NRC bills. These are citizen amendmentship acts in India, basically discriminatory acts against Muslims and minorities. That's right after they meddled with Article 370 and 35A, revoking the special status of Kashmir. And now we're seeing the farmers' protest as well. So it's not historical agendas or assumptions of what's going to happen. These are happening in real time right now. And one simple example that I want to give is how the Indian government, particularly the BJP, the RSS, they term some of these locations. So, for example, Mecca, the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they call it Makeshwar Mahadev Temple. I mean, this is what I mean when I talk about expansionist programs to create a pan-Hindu nation.
Well, Zafar, if you agree with our guest in London, why is there such silence from the international community? Because if it's true what he said, our analyst said, and that there is a racist agenda behind this, and of course the type of abuse that the Indian government is being accused of inflicting on the Kashmir region, why aren't we hearing more from the so-called international agencies?
Well, this has to do with the geostrategic interests of various powers. Right now, what we see is that the United States is targeting China because China is an emerging economic and military power, and China has also expanded its geostrategic reach into the Central Asian and the broader Eurasian landmass. And of course, Pakistan is closely aligned with China, whereas the United States and its Western allies are using India to target China and to frustrate China's plans. So you would see not only what India is doing, the atrocities and the crimes that India is perpetrating in Kashmir as well as in the rest of India, incidentally, as Muzamil pointed out, that the Muslims are being targeted. They constitute 185 million people in India. But these draconian laws, the Citizenship Amendment Act and other acts that they have introduced, and the Hindu Nazis are openly declaring that India is only, if people want to stay here, they can only stay here as Hindus, not as any other religion. So not just Muslims, but even Christians are being targeted. But the rest of the world is remaining silent because they want to use India for their geostrategic purposes, and so they overlook it. Now, if you go beyond India, you look at the Zionist state of Israel, whose policy, of course, India is following to the letter. Again, the atrocities that the Zionists perpetrate against the Palestinian people are not really addressed, because Zionist Israel is seen as a beachhead in the Muslim world that is used by the West, particularly now, of course, the United States, that uses Israel to, in fact, keep that entire region destabilized. So what we are seeing is a geostrategic chess game that is going on, in which the United States want to checkmate China, and of course, beyond that, Russia, and they see India as a partner with them. Mm-hmm. Although I want to point out that the West is going to be greatly disappointed. India will not be able to fulfill the desires of the West, because China definitely is emerging its march towards economic development, and its military power cannot be checked. Of course, China is not going to be a rival to the United States militarily within the next maybe 5 to 10 years, but beyond that it will be. But economically, there are already World Bank studies, IMF studies, and other studies that indicate that China is in fact going to supersede the United States economically by the year 2028. So it is in order to undermine China's rise that the rest of the world is remaining silent to the gross atrocities and crimes that the Indian regime is perpetrating. But I just also want to add one more point, that while it may be able to get away with it for now, I think the way history works and operates is that criminals are ultimately brought to justice. We saw yesterday the International Criminal Court in The Hague actually ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate Israeli war crimes in Gaza, as well as in the West Bank and Jerusalem, etc. So I think it's a warning that the Indian rulers should take heed of, because a day will come, a day of reckoning, when their crimes will also be brought to trial, and these Indian rulers will be held accountable.
Okay. Your thoughts, Muzamil, because as Zafar said, a day is reckoning is near, but also in his analysis of things, especially with the part that it's a chess game by the United States, by the West, and trying to limit China and also Russia. If that is the case, it appears that the situation is going to deteriorate before getting better in Kashmir. How do you see it?
Well, it's pretty accurate. We've seen the lockdown, obviously the conventional lockdown that we've seen because of COVID, and people's understandings or starting to understand what exactly COVID means and what exactly a lockdown means. In Kashmir, this is a completely different situation. It's been much, much worse. Deaths, rapes, enforced disappearances, human shields. I mean, it's a huge list of war crimes that India commits inside occupied Kashmir, and it's been exponentially growing. And now we've seen measures where they are issuing domicile certificates to non-residents, essentially changing the demography of the area. And once that happens, the indigenous people will no longer have a place to stay. We've seen this with the Rohingya. We're seeing this with the Palestinians. And this is exactly what happens when a settler colonial empire, somebody that wants to be an empire, these are the kind of tactics they use. In terms of the larger scheme of things, there is an implosion within India at this moment, particularly after the Article 317 35A being revoked, but also the CAA and the NRC. And I keep on referring back to this because the minorities started to stand up. They finally understood what the Kashmiris were talking about when we said that if you don't stand up for us today, tomorrow they're going to come for you. And even then, that kind of slow process of protesting and trying to vilify the BJP government, it still didn't pick up as much pace as it should have, until the farmers protests happened. And that has been a big stumbling block for the Indian government, where it seems like potentially that they may need to retract that position. But ultimately, what needs to happen is, as Mr. Bangash said, is that the world powers need to somehow intervene. But until and unless they recognize India as the emerging power, they want to sponsor India as the emerging power in that area, we won't see much development and much change. We've recently, of course, seen the Chinese incursion into Ladakh, claiming that territory for their own, essentially putting up a fight against the Indians. And we haven't really seen much of a reaction from the Indian government, mainly because they can't really push back against a formidable foe. But in that sense, the situation in Kashmir will exponentially get worse, and that is expected. But ultimately, what we're expecting, people like myself from Indian-occupied Kashmir, we're expecting that the international community does intervene, the ICJ does intervene, that the United Nations observers at least go into Kashmir, because they're able to go into the Pakistani side of Kashmir and have unfettered access. Whereas in Indian-occupied Kashmir, that just doesn't happen. And of course, we know about Amnesty International being banned from India for reporting on Kashmir, and there are many other organizations as well. So we do, I mean, I am expecting things to get worse, and that isn't something easy to say, because I have family there. I still have family there. My cousins are in jail. My uncle just recently died, and I can't go visit, and that's despite the COVID. So there are, this is real life politics. This is real life people's hearts and souls being entwined in this conflict and not being able to do anything. And looking at the West and seeing the kind of rights and liberties that exist for them, and yet they are, for some reason, they seem to be outlandish for the people of Kashmir when we ask for exactly the same thing. I'll probably end with this point. The fact that the farmers' controversy inside India, the common people are now standing up for rights. They use the term occupation, oppression, freedoms and liberties. They use these terms, but it is hypocritical. The Indian government, for all their faults, they have made apparent the hypocrisy within India and the double standards that exist for them and for the people of Kashmir, clearly identifying that the people of Kashmir are not technically and never have been, and nor do they ever want to be, Indians.
Well, Mazamil, staying with you, actually, I want to just briefly touch on for our viewers the current situation now in Kashmir. We know that 18 months ago this crackdown was initiated, was cut off, basically the region cut off from the world. I want you to give us a minute update on the current situation right now, the day-to-day life for people in that region now. What is it like?
With a curfew, you can imagine that you're not allowed to go outside. Communication blockades, media blackouts, nobody understanding what is actually going on, not being able to visit your own family and relatives. And then on top of that, you have another lockdown because of COVID, which makes it even worse because of fear of transmission of disease. But we've seen over the last however many months, the people of Kashmir not having access to food, to water, to medicine, to healthcare. Women that have had to give still births on the roads because the military, the occupational forces, wouldn't allow them to go to hospitals. People that have died have not been able to take funeral processions, so the dead have had to be buried in the backyard, in the gardens. We've heard about young children being pelleted. 18-month-old Hiba, she was 18 months old, sitting in her mother's lap, pelleted by the Indian army, and now she's blind in one eye. We have so many different cases inside Kashmir of war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, ethnic cleansing. Now we're seeing demographic change and settler colonialism. The crisis in Kashmir has reached its tipping point, and I would go as far as to say that it is as bad as Syria, Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, and all the other conflicts put together, mainly because of the lack of attention and the lack of intervention.
Zafa, what is it going to take to change that around? He talked about the lack of attention to bring this issue up front to the world. And what is it going to take? We talked about international community. Also, in the international community, we have billions of Muslims and independent people thinking. What will it take to bring them together in order to try to put pressure on New Delhi?
Well, first of all, I think awareness of the true situation in Indian-occupied Kashmir is absolutely vital. And as yesterday, we saw that Kashmir Solidarity Day was observed not only in Pakistan, but throughout the world, incidentally. Right here in Canada, for instance, we had a webinar on Kashmir Solidarity Day. There have been similar webinars in the United States, in Europe and elsewhere, which means that there is now awareness about the Kashmir situation emerging. Secondly, I want to take you back to June 2018 as well as July of 2019. The United Nations High Commission for Human Rights issued two reports. These were actually extremely critical of India's behavior towards the oppression of the Kashmiri people. And so it indicates that there is some awareness emerging. But as I said, I think ultimately what it needs is a concerted campaign of boycott and sanctions against India. And I think in this respect, the civil society groups all over the world can play a very significant role. Whether it's in Canada, the United States, Europe, these are important countries with which India trades. And I think if India's pocket is hit, I think it will then begin to take heed. As Muzamil pointed out, there are actually people now inside India that are waking up to the reality of the fascism that is sweeping India. And I think if more and more people were to become aware of this and mobilized, I think India can be forced to give up its very oppressive policies. And you asked about the Muslim world.
30 seconds. Go ahead.
Probably about 1.82 billion Muslims. Regrettably, Muslims are unfortunately quite divided, but I think there is an enlightened group of Muslims all around the world that feel deeply for the suffering of Muslims in any part of the world. For instance, the Palestinians, the Rohingyas, the people in Iraq or Iran or Syria or Yemen, etc. So I think there is hope from the Muslims as well. What we need to do is to increase our efforts and to bring awareness of this very, very tragic situation in Kashmir.
Indeed. And on that note, I thank both of you being with us on this debate. Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, Canada. And from the Kashmir Institute of International Affairs, Mr. Muzamil Ayub Thakir, President of World Kashmir Freedom Movement, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzieh Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Islamic Revolution, Preserver of Islamic Civilization. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the 42nd anniversary of the resounding victory of the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people over the oppressive Pahlavi regime. The day was the 11th of February 1979, but this year it falls on the 10th of February, since last year was a leap year. The victory of the Islamic Revolution put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. Stay tuned, please. Many civilizations have emerged in different parts of the world throughout history. Each civilization has experienced four phases of emergence, flourishing, decline, and destruction. Civilizations in Iran, Mesopotamia, or Iraq, Greece, Egypt, China, etc., have rendered important services to human sciences and culture. But the Islamic civilization was more important, as it flourished in a short time and rendered great services to mankind. This civilization was shaped up on the basis of the Islamic teachings, and from the beginning, it persuaded Muslims to acquire various sciences from any source. Thus, a great number of scholars were trained in different scientific fields and presented their inventions and findings. Moreover, philosophers, poets, and artists left many outstanding works behind. Unfortunately, the Islamic civilization declined like a setting sun, and the era of scientific backwardness began in the Islamic lands as the dominance of colonialist powers started. The bedazzling triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 created hope in the growth of the Islamic thought and culture once more. Some of the features of the Islamic civilization have put Iran in the course of revival of the Islamic civilization. They include growth of spirituality, scientific progress, reliance on efficient domestic forces and thinkers, increase of national power and endeavor for unifying the Islamic world. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, believes that the main path of this revolution will reach the modern civilization. After over four decades of the establishment of the Islamic Republic system, myriads of plots, problems, and enmities have failed to overthrow or divert this popular system from its main path. That's why the leader issued this highly important statement known as the second step phase of the Islamic Revolution in the 40th anniversary of this revolution. In that comprehensive statement, he has outlined the roadmap for the revolution as it enters the fifth decade of its life. He addressed the youth, saying, "The coming decades are your decades. It is you who should guard your revolution with experience and high motive, and take it ever closer to its great ideal, which is the creation of the modern Islamic civilization and preparedness for the sunrise of Imam Mahdi." In other words, the leader believes that the ultimate goal of the Islamic Revolution is to make preparations for the emergence of Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. One of the important features of every civilization is the culture that permeates in it. The Islamic civilization, unlike the Western material civilization, is based on spirituality, ethics, and belief in God. Such a civilization does not ignore and trample upon the rights of other nations once it gains power. It doesn't use sciences for illegitimate and inhumane purposes. The Islamic Revolution, as is evident from its name, is based on the progressive Islamic instructions and pursues the welfare and happiness of the individual and society, both in the material and spiritual dimensions. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "In the modern Islamic civilization, spirituality is beside materialism, and ethical ascension is beside progress in material life." The obvious characteristics of every civilization is flourishing of sciences and technologies. Since the very first year of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has made many progresses in different scientific and technological fields, despite the imposition of the eight-year war and unprecedented sanctions. With 10% growth in sciences, Iran ranks second in the world after China. It ranks fourth in nanotechnology and stands among the top nations in space technology, nuclear know-how, stem cells, production of medical equipment, and state-of-the-art military equipment, especially missiles and drones. For the past 42 years, the rate of illiteracy has decreased notably, and nearly 4 million students are studying in hundreds of universities and academic centers. In view of this, it is predicted that in the coming years, Iran will witness faster scientific growth. Usually, civilizations are weakened or perish due to external threats. For instance, the first Islamic civilization was harmed seriously by the Crusades of Europe on the West, which was almost concurrent with the Mongol invasion on the East. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as the color of the modern Islamic civilization, has been exposed to threats from the very beginning. In view of this, the Iranian military forces have been organized in a way that they are perfectly prepared for defending the country and the Islamic civilization. The point to note is that the flourishing and spread of the modern Islamic civilization, unlike the Western civilization and many other civilizations in the past, is not based on conquest and military expedition. On the contrary, it is based on the lofty divine thought and culture which impacts and rules the hearts rather than bodies. This is the very reason for the widespread propaganda smear of the West against Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Islamic civilization based on a new thought, a new word, a new look at human issues and issues of mankind is the cure for the pains of mankind. It is a novel language that the hearts of the new human generations and deprived strata in various communities understand it." Well, dear listeners, on that note, we have to wrap up this program. May God help us to play our role in preparations for the formation of the Islamic civilization. Amen.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.